Hello and welcome to the HOA Show, where we discuss the news, problems, trends, and critical issues relating to life in a homeowner association. Join us every episode, and together we'll explore how to survive and thrive in the dizzying world of HOAs.
Hello, and welcome to the HOA Show. I'm your host, Ryan Gazelle, and in this episode, we'll be discussing why every community association needs workers' compensation. I'm joined today by two extremely knowledgeable people, Tim Klein and AJ Scott, both of the Klein Agency insurance brokers. Tim is the CEO and founder of the Klein Agency, which he founded in 1998 to serve almost exclusively the insurance needs of common interest developments. Prior to starting the Klein Agency, Tim ran the largest HOA division in the country for a Los Angeles-based State Farm agency. He holds the prestigious CIRMS designation and has written countless articles and insurance board development courses for CAI. Fun fact, Tim is an accomplished musician and composer, and for years, he used to play with his band, the Jazz Miners, at Disneyland. Well done, Tim. And Andrea June Scott, who goes by AJ, joined the Klein Agency in 2006. She runs the Orange County office for the Klein Agency and holds both her CIRMS and CPCU designations. For those that are not aware, the CPCU designation, or Chartered Property Casualty Underwriter, is one of the most difficult to obtain in the insurance industry, and frankly, very few brokers or retail agents have the patience or expertise to obtain that designation. Well done, AJ. Thank you both for lending your expertise today.
Thanks so much, Ryan.
All right, let's get down to the nitty-gritty. So, AJ, I want to address this first part to you. Why do associations without employees need a workers' comp policy?
Like any insurance policy, this is one that you don't need until you need it, right? But in our experience, we've seen a few community associations unexpectedly find themselves needing this coverage. So it's not theoretical. It has happened, and it could happen to any community. We actually saw it happen to a 3-unit condo project in San Francisco a number of years ago. But state employment laws are complex, and different entities even use different criteria. And unless you're fortunate enough to have a seasoned employment attorney on your board of directors, it can be extremely difficult to predict how a court is going to classify an injured worker. Historically, in California, there were over a dozen tests that would be applied to determine whether a worker was an employee or a contractor, and you only had to meet one of those tests in order to be deemed the employer. But more recently, California adopted an ABC test that is even more stringent, further narrowing the field of who can be classified as an independent contractor.
AJ, can I ask you, what is the ABC test?
So the ABC test, there was a case out of the California Supreme Court for a shipping company called Dynamics, who had been classifying all of their drivers as independent contractors for years. And the California Supreme Court was looking at this situation and decided that, no, we need a more specific test of how to fairly determine who's an employee versus who's an independent contractor. They didn't want employers taking advantage of the classification system. So they developed these three criteria. Under this test, a worker is considered an employee and not an independent contractor unless the hiring entity or the employer satisfies all three of the following conditions. So all three have to be satisfied. Number one, the worker has to be free from control and direction of the hiring entity. So the hiring entity cannot instruct them on hours, how to perform the work. And then number two is going to be the worker performs work that is outside the usual course of the hiring entity's business. So if you're a shipping company, but all of your drivers are considered independent contractors, that's no longer going to fly under the ABC test. Their work has to be different from your work. So HOAs can meet this second requirement pretty easily. Most of the vendors that they're hiring have work that is clearly outside the scope of the HOA's operations. Number three, the worker has to be customarily engaged in an independently established trade, occupation, or business of the same nature as that involved in the work performed. So they have to consistently be performing this different work from your work. That has to be their MO. That has to be how they typically, earn their keep, so to speak.
So not a one-off. Gotcha.
Exactly. So unless all three of those are satisfied, and again, there's room for interpretation, we don't know how the courts are going to apply these three tests each and every time. Unless all three of those are satisfied, you cannot classify a worker as an independent contractor.
And I did want to add that if you are in a community and you have volunteers doing any kind of work on the property, you want to make sure that you're naming all of those folks in the board meeting minutes as being part of that committee, right?
That's right.
It's a great way to memorialize the fact that these individuals are indeed working at the direction of the board and meet the volunteer status required by the policy.
So even if you're going to change a light bulb, you're on the light bulb changing committee.
It certainly makes sense.
That's exactly right. The intent is they don't want just anyone, you know, sustaining an injury and saying, oh, well, as it so happens, I was doing work for the HOA.
Right.
They want to be sure that these people are actually volunteering for the association. So the policy language says that any volunteer working in their official capacity via a motion of the board of directors is entitled to coverage under this policy, but those prerequisites have to be in place. So at some board meeting, the board has to motion to identify these volunteers.
Great. Essentially, now the 12 steps have been laid down more stringently into three classifications or three requirements in order to determine an employee-employer relationship.
Yeah, and they're sweeping these three requirements. You know, it used to be kind of a dozen very technical, kind of focused questions, or over a dozen, I should say. But the ABC test, these are far more general and they make it really difficult and they require only a very small subset of workers that can be classified as true independent contractors.
Got it.
It's as if the employer now has the obligation to prove that the individual was not an employee. In fact, even though the IRS and others may consider the individual an independent contractor, the assumption is that the same individual is nevertheless an employee under the workers' compensation policy.
Got it.
It's really burdensome.
So it's kind of like, you know, innocent until proven guilty.
Well, guilty until proven innocent in this particular case.
There you go.
But the interesting thing about California, and I think it's true in any state that has a workers' compensation program, the workers' compensation policy in general is a no-fault policy. And that's to say, you know, the injured worker that shows up in the emergency room, one of the first questions asked was this injury employment related? If it is, automatically, it becomes a claim under the workers' compensation policy. The injured worker doesn't have to assert that the association was somehow negligent. You know, it just happened on the HOA premises, it was work-related, it becomes a claim. The only question is, who was the employer at the time of loss?
And that kind of leads us into our next question, Tim. Great segue. So who does the workers' comp policy protect, AJ? Does it protect the association or the employee?
So I think commonly we think of workers' comp as protecting the workers, but it actually protects both. It protects the employer as well. When workers' comp started in Germany in the late 1800s, the idea was that this would be a compromise between the employer and their workers. The employer was going to provide benefits for injured workers, and in exchange, the workers gave up their right to sue the employer for unspecified damages. So if you maintain workers' comp, an injured worker must accept the statutory benefits provided under the policy rather than being able to sue the association for both specific and general damages, including who knows how much for pain and suffering. So it does protect the association while extending benefits to injured workers who are deemed to be employees.
So by paying this small premium for a workers' comp policy for an association that, say, doesn't have any employees, they're essentially limiting their liability to the policy limits.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And what happens if an association doesn't have workers' comp coverage?
Well, the state of California has an uninsured employer's benefits trust fund. It just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? A UEBTF. It's a friendly acronym. An injured worker whose employer has no workers' comp can apply to the UEBTF for benefits. The trust fund pays those benefits and they require reimbursement from the uninsured employer. So in an HOA, this can translate to every unit or every lot in the project having a lien placed against it until that debt is paid. And until that lien is lifted, the owners can't sell, they can't refinance. So you've got the need to repay the uninsured trust fund and the exposure to a lawsuit like we touched on earlier.
Tim, do most CC&Rs require workers' comp coverage?
Well, most CC&Rs require the board of directors to purchase a workers' compensation policy, but only to the extent necessary to comply with state law. State law requires the association to purchase a policy when they're an employer. And of course, we don't know when that employer-employee relationship exists until there's a claim. You know, mostly CC&Rs aren't that forward-thinking enough to suggest that the association maintain a policy such as the one we're talking about here. You know, a safety net policy that would protect in the event the employer is deemed to be responsible for the injured worker. This type of policy is called a no payroll or if any policy.
So the CC&Rs state that they have to have it if they're required by law to, and essentially they won't know until the accident. And when they find out that the vendor they hired didn't have workers' comp, that they then had to have it, correct?
Right, exactly. So it's a little bit too late when they find out they need it.
All right. That's helpful.
It just reminds me, of being 16 years old in my driver's ed class. And like the first thing that happened was my instructor wrote on the whiteboard, ignorance of the law is no excuse. And workers' comp is a legally mandated coverage. You have to have it by law, maybe by your CC&Rs, but certainly by law in California if you have employees. And if you're not sure whether or not you have employees, a safety net workers' comp policy is an awfully good idea.
Sure. Now, would the general liability policy offer any sort of coverage to, say, an injured worker that was working on the association property?
Potentially, if they weren't considered an employee by a court of law. General liability policies are highly standardized, and they virtually always have exclusions for workers' comp and similar laws and employers' liability. So if, after a worker's injured, a court determines that the HOA was that individual's employer and is responsible for workers' comp benefits, the general liability policy will exclude that claim.
And what about the D&O policy? No coverage there?
No, all D&O policies have an outright exclusion for claims arising from bodily injury, so there's no coverage there either.
Tim, I remember you've told me on a number of occasions about a very famous workers' comp case that happened on the west side of Los Angeles. You want to tell us that story?
Sure. You know, the case is referred to as Hyman versus the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board. It's a 2007 California Appeals Court decision that reinforces why common interest developments of all shapes and sizes should carry a workers' compensation policy. Robert Hyman owned a management company called Pegasus Management. He managed a small association in the Brentwood area of LA called Montana Villas Homeowners Association. Realizing the rain gutters needed replacement, the board instructed the manager to get some bids. Apparently, with only one bid to review, the board opted to hire a company owned by Mark Ruby called Rube's Rain Gutter Service. Now, the contract called for the work to be completed in more than 2 days, and they were going to charge him $1,050. The work was being done by an individual named Freddie Aguilera, and Freddie was being compensated $65 a day. First day on the job, Freddie is near the top of his ladder, and he has a length of rain gutter in his hands. Unexpectedly, the gutter makes contact with a high-voltage power line. He's got serious burns, and he sustains additional injuries as a result of the fall from the ladder. The paramedics took Freddie to the nearest ER, which was at UCLA. The first questions asked as they attended his injuries was, how did you get hurt? Were these injuries work-related? And of course, you know, they were. It was shortly after Freddie was admitted to the hospital that Robert Hyman determined that Mark Ruby had no workers' compensation coverage, and he didn't have a California contractor's license. There's an interesting provision in the California Labor Code that requires that if you hire an individual for which a license is required and they do not have that license to perform the work, by default, they automatically become an employee of the property owner. Now, in this case, of course, the gutters were being installed on the common area, property owned by the Homeowners Association. So this is a perfect example of circumstances where an association doesn't have direct employees, but they nevertheless may be determined to be the employer by virtue of the fact that they hired an unlicensed contractor. And then the association becomes responsible for the potential hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical bills, his lost income, rehabilitation, and retraining. Without a workers' compensation policy, the association becomes financially responsible, but the claim is paid through the state's uninsured pool, and then there's a lien placed on the property. One way or another, financial damages become the responsibility of the property owner. In this case, it's a homeowners association.
And actually, in this particular case, correct me if I'm wrong, Wasn't it actually the management company that was deemed to be the employer because they signed the contract?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, another valuable lesson, I think, for the association and for the manager is that if you have a contract of this type, you never want to have the manager sign the contract. Or the manager should be at least advised not to sign the contract because they become potentially responsible. And in this case, they were.
Well, if you're the association, you want the manager to sign the contract. But if you're the management company, you don't. Interesting.
There's some extremely valuable lessons from this, obviously. We just talked about the fact that the manager shouldn't be signing any type of contract. Obviously, you always want to make sure that you're getting work performed by a contractor who actually has a license to perform that type of work. It's also good to get multiple bids and take the time to evaluate them a little bit more stringently. Are they licensed? Do they maintain the appropriate coverages? And take the time to contact their references.
I'd like to delve in a little bit more into what constitutes an employer-employee relationship in California. You know, we get a lot of questions about independent contractors. Are they exempt? Do they have an, are they the employee of the association?
Right. Well, so much of these issues are circumstance driven. So we really won't know until the time of loss. And that's the real challenge. You and I can call them an independent contractor. They can be deemed to be an independent contractor for the IRS or maybe any other governing body. But the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board in the state of California has its own set of rules. And the newer, broader ABC test sounds simple, and perhaps it is, but the real net result is a very broad brush defining who might be actually be an employee. And so that's the challenge for the association. We just don't know, and we won't know until there's a claim.
So you want to make sure if you're an association or the board of directors that any vendor you're hiring has workers' comp policy in place. But what about if it's a, you know, just a small sole proprietor? It's, you know, the owner of the business is the only employee himself, and he does all the work. Can he get or she get a workers' comp policy to cover themselves?
Yeah, in the state of California, there's at least one carrier that will write coverage for a sole proprietor, and that's the State of California Insurance Fund, or what is simply referred to as State Fund. And that's the kind of carrier that's the last resort in California. They do write comp policies for sole proprietors. The theme, once again, is that we won't know until there's a loss, whether or not there's an employer-employee relationship. And again, in California, the State Workers' Compensation Appeals Board is the determining body, and they're basically looking for a deep pocket. And ABC's test, which AJ probably knows better than I, is now the regulations being used to define that employer-employee relationship.
So from a best practices standpoint, even if you're hiring a sole proprietor, a single gentleman or woman that owns their company, does all their own work, you'd recommend not hiring them unless they have a workers' comp policy in place.
You know, everybody has to take time off. They may have to be hospitalized, or they may go to Vegas for the weekend, or they may have a bar mitzvah to attend. You know, there's any number of reasons that they may have to send a substitute on a given day. The day they send a substitute, they're no longer a sole proprietor.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, and the board is going to have to decide ultimately how much risk management to implement, right? It's going to be every board's decision in terms of what they're comfortable with and how careful they want to be. But this is the great thing about having that, if any, workers' comp policy as a safety net, is that if you hire a sole proprietor, typically the workers' comp insurers that we work with, as long as that sole proprietor has general liability insurance, our workers' comp carriers writing these if any policies are not going to require you to report that person's payroll at the time of your end of term audit. So they're not considering sole proprietors employees for the purpose of your if any workers' comp policy. So as long as they maintain general liability, it's okay with those carriers. However, if you don't have that workers' comp policy, that if any safety net policy, you really can't hire that sole proprietor without workers' comp insurance with certainty that they're not going to unexpectedly be deemed your employee or have some substitute come and work for you that might be deemed your employee.
AJ, you've mentioned this several times now, this if any workers' comp policy. What does that mean?
The carrier will issue the policy at their minimum premium. So the floor amount of premium that they require for a policy to go out the door. And they will just schedule the HOA operations class code on the policy, and instead of listing an amount of payroll, they'll just say, if any, like Tim said earlier, a no-fault policy that if someone is injured and that person is deemed to be the association's employee, that person gets picked up automatically. They don't need to be scheduled on the policy in advance. It's a safety net. It's an if any policy.
So we often call it a zero payroll policy, but essentially they're just assuming a minimal payroll policy, right?
That's right. So because they're already paying a minimum premium, even if you have, you know, a couple of workers that do need to, for some reason, be reported to the carrier at the time of audit, say you hired somebody that didn't have insurance or didn't have a license, and whoops, we need to report that person now to the carrier because they, you know, weren't technically an independent contractor by the carrier standards, you might still be within that minimum premium. You're not necessarily going to owe an additional premium after the policy is audited. However, if you're already hiring a bunch of unlicensed, uninsured workers, you're not going to be eligible for one of these minimum payroll policies. You can get one from the state fund that Tim mentioned a few minutes ago, but you won't be able to get one at these kind of $400 and less premiums that we're talking about that are available for associations that have a truly incidental exposure if you're habitually hiring unlicensed, uninsured workers. I hope that makes sense.
But in the case of like a handy person, they're not required to have workers' comp coverage, correct?
Well, Ryan, that's a great question. There's some debate about that in California. There's actually no handyman classification. And yet the handyman might be performing work from time to time for which a license is required. Installing light switches, replacing a leaky faucet or a toilet. So I don't think we can really weigh definitively and say that the handyman doesn't have to have workers' compensation coverage. I think there's probably some difficulty where it might indeed be needed in certain cases.
And how would you know, Tim, if the work that's being performed would require a license?
Well, you know, there are currently 44 different contractor license classifications listed at the California Contractor State License Board website. That website address, by the way, is www.cslb.ca.gov. It's at this website that you'll find detailed descriptions of the type of work performed by the individual for which a license is required. You may be asking yourself, why are we spending so much time talking about contractor's licenses when this is supposed to be a discussion on workers' comp? Well, a contractor's license can be a substantial proof that an independent contractor relationship exists. I think the important point to take away from all of this is if your association might be calling somebody at 2 in the morning to respond to a burst water pipe, by maintaining a no payroll safety net policy, you don't have to wait by your fax machine, if you still have one of those, or by your cell phone or whatever to see a workers' compensation policy before you can hire that individual. We know that there's a safety net protecting the HOA, and that's what we're concerned about. That's our client, the association. And ultimately, that's the purpose of this.
So this minimum premium policy that are available from a number of carriers would simply do that. And they can jump through all the hoops they want to jump through, do their due diligence. But essentially, if you've got this in your back pocket, you're protected.
Right. We often kid that having a workers' compensation policy doesn't give you a license for hiring unlicensed contractors.
Correct.
You still want to exercise, you know, the same kind of risk management you've always had in the past. Always make sure that you do have a license and insured contractors, and just use this workers' compensation policy as a safety net.
Okay.
But it's worth pointing out that an added benefit of a lot of these policies, not all, you should always check, but a lot of these, if any, policies written for community associations have a voluntary compensation extension. That's what the endorsement is called, a voluntary comp endorsement that extends coverage to board and appointed committee members if they're working on the association's behalf in their official capacity, as long as they're not doing work for which a license or specialized training is required. So that's an added benefit of these policies, is that you're able to offer some statutory benefit to an injured board member if they are hurt while working on association business.
For example, they're doing a walkthrough or something like that, AJ? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, or maybe a gardening committee or something going out to plant some new things?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And AJ, can you touch on what are the two coverages in the workers' comp policy? There's workers' comp and there's employer's liability, right?
Sure, yeah. Workers' comp is coverage one, the first piece, and that's going to pay statutory benefits to an injured worker. So the state has a schedule of, you know, prescribed schedule of payments for different types of injuries. And so if you, you know, lose a finger or break a leg, or the state will pay for their care, they'll offer these statutory benefits for different types of injuries. the second coverage, employer's liability, this is subject to dollar amount limits. That's where you see $500,000 or $1 million in coverage. And that piece of the policy is not for the injured worker themselves, but for the more collateral damage, a spouse or a family member that might allege loss of consortium because the worker was injured and it's the employer's liable for their injury. So in that case, there is a need to prove negligence on the part of the employer, and it functions more like a traditional liability insurance policy where it is subject to specific scheduled limits on the policy.
And Tim, question for you. I know on the general liability side, when we have clients that are getting certificates of insurance from their vendors, they want to make sure that they're added additionally insured on the general liability. Do they need to be concerned about that with the workers' comp?
Actually, that's a great question, Ryan. There's not a way for the association to become an additional insured on the workers' compensation policy of the vendor. In California, for example, I think you can only be added as an additional insured if you own at least 51% or more of that entity. Obviously, that's not going to happen in this case. So all you can really do in those circumstances is just to require evidence of workers' compensation coverage.
So we heard one case from you, Tim, about Rube's Rain Gutters and poor Freddie Aguilera. AJ, you mentioned a three-unit condo association in San Francisco. What was that claim?
They had hired a painter just to paint the exterior of their building, and there was an injury during the course of work, and the HOA was held responsible as the employer because the painter had there was no workers' comp insurance. There was a license required. They hired an unlicensed worker to do that job.
Interesting. You guys have anything else to add before we kind of go over the best practices?
Not me.
Then let's go over the best practices. Essentially, to lay it out in a nutshell, we want to make sure that any association is getting their own minimal payroll workers' comp policy, or a zero payroll policy, as we commonly refer to it, because that's going to protect you on a blanket level, right?
Exactly.
And then beyond that, making sure to the degree that you can that all of your vendors that you hire have workers' comp coverage in place. And if they're a sole proprietor like a gardener or a handy person, they can get coverage from the state fund. So you want to make sure that they get that coverage if they can. But it all comes down to essentially the board's comfortability, right?
Yeah, every board has a different risk tolerance, right? And a different budget. And let's face it, if you're hiring licensed and insured workers, it's often going to cost more. So each board has to decide how much risk are we willing to take on the association, and how much do we want to continue to transfer to our workers? Are we willing to budget a little more for the people that we're hiring to ensure that we're not going to be on the hook for workers' comp benefits if something does go south?
And we mentioned this briefly, but I don't think we really delved into it. You know, workers' comp policies are auditable. Tim, what does that mean?
Well, technically, at the end of the policy term, the carrier can come back and require the association to complete an audit. These are typically conducted by mail or by telephone, depending on the carrier. And they'll ask the board or the manager to disclose what vendors were hired during the course of the year and what compensation was paid or remuneration was paid to that individual. They'll also require the association to show they have a current cert evidencing the vendor maintains their own coverage and or a California contractor's license number. If the person completing the form is unable to produce evidence of workers' comp coverage or evidence of an independent contractor relationship that would hold water, then the premium will be picked up for that course of the year.
So essentially, they're just trying to get it right. They're trying to make sure that they're compensated for the actual payroll, for the exposure that they really had. And if you have an association that does have employees, you could potentially get a refund at the end of that audit, correct?
Yeah, depending on how the audit turns out, if you've overpaid, you definitely will get a premium refund paid above the minimum premium listed on the policy. Since the audit occurs a month or so into the new policy term, the California Insurance Code requires the carrier to adjust not only the prior premium, but to adjust premium on the new policy going forward. So in that case, a $100 premium adjustment would result in a $200 invoice, $100 for the prior term and $100 for the current term. That always comes as a bit of a surprise.
And I want to just add the website for that California State Licensing Board check on the licenses, www.cslb.ca.gov. Tim, did you have anything else to add as far as the best practices go for our communities?
You know, one thing that I would suggest for the board and the manager is to require a waiver of subrogation provision. It's in favor of the association and the management agent. I mentioned it earlier that workers' compensation policies are circumstances where the associations cannot be added as an additional insured. But you can request that the association's vendor provide evidence of a waiver of subrogation endorsement. And that is an interesting policy provision that basically says that the vendor's workers' compensation policy will respond to a claim if it's a covered loss, and the carrier waives its right of recovery. That is no subrogation opportunity against the association. So what would happen in this case, and if there was an injured worker, let's say a landscaping employee was injured on the premises, the landscaping company workers' compensation policy would pay the claim, but would furthermore waive the opportunity to subrogate against the association or to recover for the injury sustained. And that would just be an added benefit to the association to ask for that waiver of subrogation endorsement.
Does that usually cost more money for the vendor?
Yeah, they're usually able to add it on a blanket basis to their policy for a percentage of their annual premium, usually between 3 and 5%, or they can add it on a one-off basis for a flat charge. So it does cost them something, but this is a frequent contractual requirement for vendors. Many of them do maintain this coverage, but it has to be triggered by a contractual requirement. So that blanket additional insured endorsement, the contract language has to be there, which is why it's so important that associations review their contracts with legal counsel, have a standardized contract in place that you use with your vendors habitually.
So essentially they'll say in the blanket waiver that we'll offer this waiver of subrogation only if required by contract.
Exactly, to any entity with whom you have agreed in writing to do so.
So very important, as always, to have legal counsel review the contract.
Sure is.
And to Tim's point, our clients and all folks in the HOA industry should be asking for this waiver of subrogation on a workers' comp policy.
It sure makes sense. Otherwise, a claim is paid by the vendor's workers' compensation carrier can end up being a potentially large general liability claim for the association. And of course, if the association is deemed to have been negligent, we hope there would be coverage under the GL policy. If not an uncovered loss, it could be even worse.
Thank you guys both so much for joining us today and explaining all this.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan.
It's fascinating, and it seems like a very inexpensive way to prevent a whole lot of pain and suffering for the association, at least, not the employee. Tim, where can our listeners go for more information like this?
For more information about workers' compensation policies, our website address has two wonderful resources. There's not only a video on the subject that individuals can share with their boards, there's also an article or two on workers' compensation coverage for homeowners associations that stresses the importance of this type of, if any, minimum payroll policy.
Great.
Our website address is www.kleinagency.com, and Klein is spelled with a C.
Klein with a C. All right. Well, that's our show for today. A special thanks to our experts, Tim Klein and AJ Scott, for their time and wisdom. As we end our episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for topics you'd like to learn about, you can email us at feedback@hoashow.org. Join us next time on The HOA Show.
To share or subscribe to The HOA Show, visit us at hoashow.org. There, you'll be able to listen to other episodes, find helpful resources relating to HOAs, provide feedback, submit questions, and check out other great stuff. The HOA Show podcast has been made possible by the contributions of Klein Agency Insurance Brokers, leaders in the community association industry. The views and opinions expressed by the podcast, its presenters and guests, do not constitute legal advice. For more information on how the topics and discussion apply to you, please consult with your own legal counsel.